This is the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. You know, on this week's program, I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach. Today on the Everything Financial Radio program, I want to talk to you about where we are today, economically speaking, what it might mean for you and your money, but I want to do so in the context of history. My history teacher would be proud that we're having this conversation today. In the book, New Retirement Rules, I write about the fact that human behavior is predictable. Many of you would undoubtedly agree with that. And because human behavior is predictable, the decisions made by policymakers and groups of politicians also tend to be predictable. And to understand where we are today, economically speaking, you need to understand something called the money currency cycle. Now, the bottom line, in my opinion, is that money and currency evolve. In short, money changes over time. And as it changes, when one studies history, you find that this money change follows the same course or cycle each time. This cycle of change has repeated itself over and over again throughout history. Now, what you need to understand about this money currency cycle change is that it occurs gradually. It occurs so slowly, in fact, that everyday citizens don't notice, and for that matter, neither do many professionals in the financial industry. The full money currency cycle takes, on average, about one long human life to complete. So let's look at history. Currency starts out as something tangible. Now, this has often been the case in history. In fact, you can go back and look at early settlers in the United States and look at what they used in commerce, and they used beaver pelts as currency or a medium of exchange. Mayan Indians used feathers from a specific bird as currency, and most commonly throughout history, precious metals such as gold and silver have been used in commerce. Now, this is the first step in this money currency cycle, and there are four steps that I'll talk about with you today in this segment. Step number one, again, currency is something tangible. The currency circulating has real, tangible, intrinsic value in and of itself. Now, the next evolution in this money currency cycle is that currency now becomes paper. However, the paper is redeemable for a tangible item with intrinsic value, which is usually a precious metal. Now, let me give you an example of this step in the money currency cycle, and this can be found fairly recently in U.S. history. In fact, I bet a lot of you listening to the Everything Financial Radio program today will remember this. If I use the term silver certificate, that probably conjures up a picture in your mind of a green bill that looks a lot like the bills we use today. The only difference is at the bottom of the bill, it says payable in silver to the bearer on demand. Now, silver certificates were printed in the United States from the 1870s through the 1960s. Now, these certificates really didn't have any inherent or intrinsic or tangible value of their own, but they could be redeemed for coins containing a fixed amount of silver. So while the paper silver certificates didn't have any built-in value in and of themselves, the coins for which the silver certificates could be redeemed did have core value. Now, if you happen to have silver coins minted pre-1965, for every $100 in coins that you owned, you also possessed 72 ounces of silver. Now, if you happen to have the paper silver certificates, you could go redeem those for the silver coins, and you could still get the same 72 ounces of silver. So, if you had 400 quarters, you had $100 in face amount, you had 72 ounces of silver. 200 half dollars, same 72 ounces of silver. 100 silver dollars, 1,000 dimes, you had the same 72 ounces of silver. The paper currency, the silver certificate, had no tangible value, but the paper note could be exchanged for something with tangible value. And this brings me to a very interesting point that's relevant to you today. If you happen to have today $100 in face amount, if you have 400 quarters, you have 72 ounces of silver. Well, roughly speaking, we'll say silver is worth about 20 bucks an ounce. That is around $140 worth of value in today's dollars. Now, if you happen to have a $10 silver certificate, it's worth a whole lot less than that. And yet, at one time, the silver certificate and the silver had the same buying power. That's really what you want to understand. Over time, the paper tends to lose purchasing power. And over time, the item or the coin with intrinsic value tends to retain purchasing power. And this has been the case almost always throughout history from my study of history. Now, if you're just joining us, this is a special edition of the Everything Financial Radio program today. And we're talking to you today about historical patterns that are relevant today. Winston Churchill said that if you want to understand the future, you have to look deeply into the past. Also, if you're just joining us, let me remind you that we do have some educational resources available here in the Grand Rapids area as well. On Thursday, September 8th, we'll be at Stonewater Country Club out in Caledonia, and on Tuesday, September 13th at Boulder Creek Golf Club. Both of these dates have us hosting our Social Security Maximization Workshop. At Stonewater Country Club on September 8th and at Boulder Creek Golf Club on September 13th, we'll begin our meetings at 6 p.m. We'll conclude at 7:30 p.m. when a complimentary dinner will be served. When you decide to come to the meeting, you'll learn how to potentially increase your Social Security benefits by as much as 32%. We'll talk about how you might be able to collect a free spousal benefit, even if you're divorced. We'll talk about how to potentially avoid paying taxes on your Social Security benefits and how to coordinate Social Security with your personal savings and investments. And we also talk about the future of Social Security. So if you'd like to get some more information on our Social Security Maximization Workshops, again, Thursday, September 8th at Stonewater Country Club, Thursday, September 13th at Boulder Creek Golf Club, visit the website socialsecurityradio.com. The website, again, is socialsecurityradio.com, and you can register or you can get more information if you'd like as well. Well, we're talking about the money currency cycle, and I talked to you about the fact that the first stage in the money currency cycle is that currency has intrinsic value. The second step in the cycle is when there is a paper certificate, a paper receipt, if you will, that's redeemable for this item with tangible value. And then we go to the third phase of the money cycle. Well, what happens during this third stage or third step of the money currency cycle? Well, essentially the link between the paper and the tangible asset is eliminated. See, a $10 silver certificate, a $10 bill, was redeemable back in 1964 for 10 silver dollars, 7.2 ounces of silver. Today, silver has really retained its purchasing power, but the value of the paper receipt or the purchasing power of the paper receipt has declined. See, this advent of a fiat currency is the third step in the money currency cycle. And here is where this is relevant to you. Today, every currency in the world is a fiat currency. This has been the case since the link between the Swiss franc and gold was eliminated back in 1997. So that is 19 years ago. This is also, according to my study of history, the first time in recorded monetary history that every world currency is a fiat currency. Now, fiat currencies are far from something new. Even before paper money existed, fiat currencies existed. You need to just open your Bible and see the reference to the Roman denarius. Well, the Roman denarius in the year 1 AD was mostly silver. By the time the Roman Empire fell, the denarius contained no silver. Now, the final step in the money currency cycle is the failure of a fiat currency. It's occurred over and over again throughout history. In fact, there has never been a fiat currency that survived long term. Then we see a money currency reset. See, when a fiat currency fails, the monetary system goes back and reverts to the first step in the money currency cycle. Typically, what happens is tangible stuff such as gold and silver are once again used as currency. So where are we today? Well, one needs only look around the world at Venezuela. They are experiencing inflation bordering on hyperinflation, and I believe we will see a currency crisis there very soon. And as choices are made by policymakers that instead of raising taxes to close a budget deficit, instead of cutting spending to close a budget deficit, they decide to print currency, we will see more and more of this. Now, this is not a new phenomenon. In the next segment, I'll give you some facts about hyperinflations and currency failures that may surprise you. This is the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Thanks for listening today. We are talking today about the currency money cycle. And it's really a lesson in how monies and currencies change over time. And as we talked about in the first segment, money and currency changes over time because when one studies history, you look at what politicians and policymakers have as far as choices are concerned when it comes to dealing with a budget deficit, and they can either raise taxes, they can cut spending, or they can print currency. Now, the last phase of the money currency cycle was reached here in the United States in 1971. Now, prior to 1971, the U.S. dollar was exchangeable for gold, but it was kind of a weird situation because it was exchangeable only for foreign investors. See, at that time, U.S. citizens could still not legally own gold. In 1933, in order to attempt to combat the symptoms of the Great Depression, then President Franklin Roosevelt made it illegal for American citizens to own gold. He did that so he could print paper currency, distribute it, spend money heavily in an attempt to combat the symptoms of the Great Depression. Now, many of us would argue that it really didn't help. But in 1971, then President Nixon closed the gold window, as the history books say. He temporarily suspended the redemptions of U.S. dollars for gold by foreign investors, and those redemptions have never resumed. Well, since that time, the U.S. dollar has literally floated against other world currencies. And since 1971, since the dollar, since the paper currency wasn't redeemable for a specific amount of gold, it's freed up the Federal Reserve to print currency if need be, or to have loose money policies that tend to increase the money supply. Now, just take a look at what happened. Now, what I did in preparation for today's program is went to an online inflation calculator. An item that cost $35 in 1971, which is exactly what an ounce of gold sold for in 1971, would today cost, according to this inflation calculator, about $208. So that's how much purchasing power the U.S. dollar has lost, somewhere between six and sevenfold. Now, by comparison, as I said, gold sold for $35 per ounce in 1971, and today, as I'm recording this segment to air, it's more than $1,300 per ounce. So when you look at the difference, consumer prices increased more than sixfold from 1971 to the present time, while the price of gold per ounce increased by more than 37-fold. So gold actually gained in purchasing power as the U.S. dollar's purchasing power declined. Now, am I suggesting that you run out and buy gold? No, I'm not. That's not our objective here on the Everything Financial Radio program. We're here to educate you, to give you some ideas and some thoughts that you can share with whomever advises you. Now, this comparison of consumer prices and gold is interesting when you look at other time frames as well. An item that cost $250 in 2000, 16 years ago roughly, would today cost about $350. Again, that's a big loss in purchasing power for the U.S. dollar. By comparison, gold sold for around $250 an ounce in 2000, and today sells for more than $1,300 per ounce at the time of this writing, at the time of this broadcast, actually, as I previously stated. So consumer prices increased about 40% from 2000 to the present, while the price of gold increased by more than 500%. So once again, over this time frame, gold actually gained in purchasing power as the U.S. dollar's purchasing power declined. So over the long term, it's certainly something to think about. And when you look at what today's policymakers and politicians have to deal with as far as a nearly $19.5 trillion national debt, Social Security and Medicare underfunding that is significant, you have to ask yourself, are taxes going to go up? Is spending going to be cut? Or is there going to be more loose money policies moving ahead? Now, when loose money policies get out of control, something called a hyperinflation can happen. Now, many of you probably remember the picture in your history books, maybe when you were back in middle school, used to be called junior high school, where you saw pictures of German citizens in Weimar, Germany, taking wheelbarrow loads of German marks, cash, to buy loaves of bread. That's obviously one of the most famous hyperinflations that has ever occurred. And according to Casey Research, where I got this information, the hyperinflation saw consumer prices increase from literally 1919 in January to November of 1923. So when you look at this, over 4.5 years, the average price over this time frame increased by a factor of $20 billion. Now, taking a look at what we just did, how did gold do? Well, Casey Research did a study. And in 1919, gold sold for 170 German marks. By November of 1923, that same ounce of gold sold for 87 trillion German marks. Consumer prices increased by a factor of $20 billion, while the price of gold increased by more than $500 billion. So certainly it's something to consider and think about. And when you look at what's going on in Venezuela right now, you're seeing a hyperinflation there as well. Now, hyperinflations are more common than one might think. Since 1920, according to one study, there have been 55 hyperinflations worldwide. Now, many of these are very small countries, but when you look at this from a worldwide perspective, that's one hyperinflation more frequently than every 2 years on average. Certainly something you want to be aware of, and certainly something that you want to potentially think about hedging from in your portfolio. This is the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. It is a special edition of the Everything Financial Radio program. We're educating you on money and currency cycles and potential economic outcomes. We'll be back after these words. This is the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Thanks for listening today. You know, here on the Everything Financial Radio program, we aired a couple months ago an interview with Mr. John Rubino. Mr. Rubino is the host of the website dollarcollapse.com. And obviously from that website, it's very easy to determine what Mr. Rubino's perspective is. But I would like to share with you again today, in the interest of, again, of talking about these money currency cycles, the interview that I did with Mr. Rubino. Now, before I get to that interview, let me remind you that we do have some additional educational resources, particularly for those of you that are trying to determine the best way to collect your Social Security benefits. If you're between the ages of 55 and 69, we have a couple of free Social Security maximization workshops I'd like to make you aware of. One will be held on Thursday, September 8 at Stonewater Country Club. The other will be held on Tuesday, September 13 at Boulder Creek Golf Club. Stonewater Country Club is out in Caledonia Township. Boulder Creek Golf Club is in Belmont. Both meetings begin at 6 p.m. and conclude with a complimentary dinner at 7:30 p.m. If you'd like to attend the events, you'll learn how to potentially increase your Social Security benefits by as much as 32%, how you might be able to collect a free spousal benefit even if you're divorced, how to potentially avoid paying tax on your Social Security benefits, and how you can coordinate Social Security with your personal savings and investments. And we'll also talk about the future of Social Security. In other words, what's the solvency of the Social Security system? So again, at both locations, September 8 at Stonewater, September 13 at Boulder Creek. We'll begin at 6 p.m., conclude with a complimentary meal at 7:30 p.m. More information is available at socialsecurityradio.com. You can also register there on the right-hand side of the webpage while capacity remains. Again, the website, socialsecurityradio.com. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. John Rubino. John's website is dollarcollapse.com. I would encourage you to check that out. His most recent book, co-authored with James Turk, is titled The Money Bubble. And I also have had the pleasure of reading one of John's many other books, which is titled The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. And John, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Hey, Dennis. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, John, let's talk first about the big news. Stock markets, anyway, as we're recording this the Monday before this program begins to air, are reacting very negatively to the UK referendum, which had Britain voting to leave the UK, or the EU. How do you see this playing out long term?
Yeah, well, long term is a harder call in Britain's case, Dennis, because it's not clear exactly how you divorce yourself from something like the European Union. So they've got a lot of questions to answer. In the short run, things are actually going well for them because the pound is way down. So they're kind of winning the currency war. You know, when your currency gets cheaper, it benefits your country at the expense of your trading partners in a lot of ways, because the stuff you're selling to the rest of the world gets cheaper because you're pricing it in your local currency, which is being devalued. And so it's easier to sell stuff to the rest of the world. You make more money, you hire more people. Generally, your economy grows. And so as far as that goes, Britain is seeing some benefits because its currency is cheaper. Whether, you know, pulling out of the EU leads to chaos in their banking system or whatever, we'll find out later. And, you know, nobody really knows. But I think what Brexit really represents is the start of a trend. And the trend is pretty disturbing because now seven or eight other European countries want to have referendums of their own on whether to pull out of the EU. And if that gains momentum, then we're going to see the single biggest economic entity in the world start to dissolve. That's going to be a really big deal for a couple of reasons. One is because obviously that'll cause a lot of chaos if it happens. And the other is that it's going to happen in piecemeal process over a long period of time where, you know, first it's France voting to leave, and then it's Spain, and then it's Portugal. And so this will continue for, you know, years before it plays out, which means there's going to be uncertainty in the markets for a really long time. And investors hate uncertainty, and so do capitalists. You know, if you're going to build a factory that's going to pay you off over 30 years, you kind of want a good sense of what the world is going to be like over that time period. And to the extent that the dissolution of the European Union makes it harder to predict what the world's going to be like, you're going to be less likely to build that factory. So growth slows down, equity and bond prices deteriorate, and volatility goes up. That's the kind of world that we're looking at if Brexit turns out to be the beginning of a trend, which it clearly looks like it is. So, you know, I think in a lot of ways, Britain had a point in not wanting to be part of the European Union, because that's really a badly run organization with a lot of, you know, fascist tendencies, frankly. But the result of what this thing kicked off is going to be with us for a long time, and overall, generally, the impact will be negative.
So, John, when I heard this news, and when you see what's going on worldwide now, I see some parallels between now and the early 1930s, when you saw this whole protectionism movement, this nationalization fervor, if you will, rise, and as a result, world trade plummeted, and many historians would say it really exacerbated the symptoms of the Great Depression. Aren't we kind of seeing, you know, a second performance or a repeat performance then? It's just that the tools are a little bit different?
Yeah, we really are. This in a lot of ways, is like the late 1920s, early 1930s. You know, you could make the case that we're already in a depression that that began maybe in 2000 with the tech stock bubble bursting, and that we're hiding the impact of the depression by being able to borrow money and create new currency, because now all the world's central banks have printing presses where they can create as much new currency as they want to, which they didn't back in the 1930s. And food stamps, for instance, in the U.S. are electronic. We just send people money, so you don't have these images of people standing in line for soup kitchens and things like that, like we have from the Great Depression. But we actually have more people getting public assistance now than back then. So in a lot of ways, something that historians will call a depression has already begun, and we're deeply into it now. And so in that sense, Brexit and the, you know, the breakup of the European Union is part of the script that you would normally expect. You know, if we're in a depression, then you would expect protectionism and nationalism to be on the rise, because that's what you do when you're worried. You know, if you're really confident and you think the future is going to be bright, then free trade agreements and globalization seem reasonable. But when you're struggling for survival, you want to protect what you've got. And that leads to calls for protectionism and the rise of nationalist politicians. And we're, you know, we're certainly seeing that around the world. So I think in a lot of ways that are a little more subtle than, you know, than allow most people to get it, we have entered a period of really, really hard times. And a lot of the politics that seem so crazy now are just natural outgrowths of an economic crisis. You know, when you see fringe political parties around the world move to the mainstream, you know, and become the big vote getters, like in France, where Marine Le Pen of the National Front is the most popular politician. Well, the National Front was kind of considered way, way out of the mainstream, extremely far right, and a very much fringe party just a few years ago. And now it's very possible that their leader is going to be the next president of France. And you're seeing that across Europe. You know, fringe parties are getting a lot of votes and in some cases participating in the governments that are being formed. And in the U.S., you've got Bernie Sanders on the left, an avowed socialist, getting a ton of votes and drawing huge crowds. And Donald Trump on the right, who is, I don't know what, but, you know, somebody who's clearly outside the political mainstream, who's now the Republican candidate for president. And so all of this is part of basically a package of a financial crisis that is due to us borrowing too much money and then just giving governments the ability to print as much new currency as they want to in order to finance all the debts they're taking on. And so, you know, that started in 1971 when the U.S. went off the gold standard and basically broke the link between the world's fiat currencies and anything tangible that would control their increase in supply. And so since that time, you've gotten pretty much what you would expect if you hand unlimited printing presses to elected officials and their appointed bureaucrats. You know, you've got a massive increase of debt year after year after year, and increasing financial instability and inflation in financial assets, which create bubbles, which pop and cause more turmoil. You know, that's where we are. And this can't end well. You know, it can only end with a major financial crisis of some sort. And based on the numbers, if the numbers in terms of the amount of debt we've taken on and the amount of leverage that we've applied to the global financial system, the reckoning should be commensurately huge. It should be bigger than anything that's happened in really human history, because the numbers have never been this outrageous. And so what's coming is hard to predict because it's uncharted territory. You know, we've never been this indebted at the same time governments have unlimited printing presses. So the craziness that we've seen up to this point are probably just foothills on the way to the mountain. You know, and the mountain is some kind of a crisis that that is going to be hard for us to imagine, and even harder to accept when it happens. But it does seem to be coming.
Well, the bad news is that's all the time we have for this segment. But the good news is we have Mr. John Rubino for another segment. We'll be talking to him about his forecast for financial markets and what it might mean for you and your money when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. You are listening to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. I'll get right back to my interview with Mr. John Rubino. Pleased to be joined today on the Everything Financial Radio program by Mr. John Rubino. John's website is dollarcollapse.com. I would encourage you to check it out. And his most recent book, co-authored with James Turk, a past guest here on the Everything Financial Radio program, is titled The Money Bubble. And John, in the last segment, we were talking about the fact that the debt levels are literally unprecedented, both in the public sector and private sector. And that issue is combined with another phenomenon, I guess, and if you want to use that term, that governments now have access to printing presses. History, though, teaches us that whenever money is printed, it can only be printed for a while before confidence is lost in the currency, and then the economic problems get even bigger. So when does the money printing stop?
Well, Dennis, that's the big question. Because, frankly, I thought 2005 or so was the end of the road for this current crazy financial system. But it's managed to hold on a lot longer than seemed reasonable back then. And part of the reason is that it's global. Every major country has an unlimited fiat currency printing press. In other words, they can make as much new money as they want to. And that power is great for fooling people. It allows you to manipulate interest rates to levels that make it seem like things are okay, and to intervene in the stock and bond markets and push financial asset prices up in ways that also make people think the world is okay. But really, all that's happening is that we're inflating the value of lots of financial assets by creating new currency. And that's not new wealth. That's just make-believe paper. And eventually, that kind of thing blows up on you. And what happens is people gradually come to realize that it's the explicit policy of their government to make their currency worth less year after year, and that they're going to continue to do that for as far as the eye can see. So people lose faith in the currency. They decide that they don't want to hold it anymore because they know it's going to be worth less and less and less. So as soon as they get paid, they convert their paycheck into real stuff. They go out and they buy land, or they buy gold and silver, or they buy, oil wells, or any kind of real asset that governments can't create more of, and the price of those things just go through the roof. And that, it manifests as inflation, but what it really is a loss of confidence in the currency. And when a critical mass of people start acting that way, the system spins out of control. And in the Austrian School of Economics, they have a term for it. It's called the crack-up boom. And I think you could make the case that we're in the early stage of that process, because already capital is flowing aggressively into things that that are real. You know, the price of London penthouses is at an all-time record, and fine art keeps being auctioned at higher and higher prices. And what that means is that the people with extra cash, the rich folks of the world, are converting that cash into real stuff because they don't want to hold it anymore. And as governments get into deeper and deeper financial trouble, like, for instance, what's happening in Europe and Japan and China and the U.S., the temptation to try to devalue their currencies really aggressively to get out from under their debts is going to become overwhelming. And we're going to hit the next stage of the process, which I think is coming soon, where as crazy as the last few years financial and monetary policies have seemed, the next batch will be even crazier. And that batch will involve massive new government deficit spending and even more negative interest rates. You know, in the U.S., conceivably, by this time next year, you'll be able to borrow money to buy a house, and the bank will pay you instead of you paying the bank. And once that happens, all bets are off, because we're kind of in an economic twilight zone where the old laws of finance don't apply anymore. And so the system will almost certainly spin out of control. So it becomes a question of timing. You know, does it happen late this year, early next year, or does it happen 2025? And that's what we can't know, because it's turning out that a printing press is such an excellent tool for fooling people that it allows these governments to keep it going much longer than they should be able to. In the meantime, though, for regular people, it makes sense to accept that this can't be stopped and can't be changed. You know, it doesn't matter who we vote for, and it doesn't really matter what we do in our personal lives. The institutional momentum of the global financial system is going to take us off that cliff. So for us, we need to be thinking about what we can do to protect ourselves and our families from this eventual crisis. And gold and silver are a pretty good bet and pretty accessible for the average person. You know, you can go out and buy some silver coins, and because silver, along with gold, are forms of money that have been around for 3,000 years and have held their value for a long time and can't be created in infinite quantities on a printing press. You know, you have to dig it out of the ground, and we only get about 2% more each year, and so its supply is constrained. Those things tend to hold their value because of those reasons. And so that's something an individual can do to protect themselves. You know, if you own a lot of gold and silver in accessible forms, then your capital will tend to rise in local currency terms. In other words, the dollar value of your gold and silver will go up in price, and that'll protect your purchasing power. You'll be able to continue to buy stuff to live a relatively normal life if you have assets like that that go up in value when the currency in which you're measuring them goes down. So, again, that's coming. We don't know when it's going to come, but preparing now for it is probably a good idea. And we're seeing that lately. You know, gold and silver really popped when the Brexit news hit. And the reason for that is that that's where we hide out in times of turmoil. And this is clearly a time of turmoil. So I think it's reasonable to expect, you know, with a lot of fluctuation, but in gold and silver to go up in a general trend for the next few years. So, you know, maybe it bounces around in the near term, but I think 2 years from now and 5 years from now and 10 years from now, the price of gold and probably of silver will be considerably higher than today.
So, John, one of the things that I like to look at is the Dow gold ratio, because it's got a lot of years of history. And when you take a look at, you know, where the Dow gold ratio has been at the end of other periods of turmoil, a lot of times you see the Dow and gold at a 1-to-1 or maybe 2-to-1 ratio. I don't know how familiar you are with the Dow to gold ratio, but do you see that you know, the Dow and gold could end up on par at some point?
Well, yeah, as recently as 1980, an ounce of gold would buy you the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And basically, what we're talking about here is a periodic shift between real assets and financial assets in the markets. And at times like this, we've had a long, long pendulum swing in favor of financial assets because governments have been actively inflating financial assets by creating huge amounts of new currency that flow into the stock market. And so now we've got what the stock market is about 12 times the price of gold. And the pendulum usually swings, as you said, back to 1-to-1. So from here on out, it's a pretty good bet that gold outperforms U.S. equities. and that eventually we'll get back to, you know, 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 or something like that, you know, somewhere around equality. And so over that long period of time, gold will be an asset that works for you much better than a diversified portfolio of stocks. So from, say, 1970 to 1980, even though the stock market went up, gold went up a lot faster. And it's possible that the same thing happens again. You know, the governments of the world inflate away their currencies, and that makes the stock market go up because we're measuring it in less and less valuable dollars. But gold goes up much faster. So it could be that, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average will be at 25,000, up from today's 17,000 5 years from now. But gold will be $20,000 an ounce, up from 1,300 today. So, you know, you in theory, you make money in either asset class, but you make a lot more money in the real assets because that's the direction that the pendulum is swinging for the next decade or two.
Well, that is going to, or the clock, I guess, is going to tell us that we're out of time here. Our guest today has been Mr. John Rubino. His website is dollarcollapse.com. His most recent book, one of many, is The Money Bubble. I would encourage you to check them both out. And, John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Dennis.
Well, that's just about all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to the Everything Financial Radio program. Glad you decided to tune in, and certainly hope you got something you can use. And as I close today, let me remind you again of our two Social Security Maximization workshops coming up on Thursday, September 8th at Stonewater Country Club, that's out in Caledonia Township, and on Tuesday, September 13th at Boulder Creek Golf Club, and that's out in Belmont. You can get more information or register while capacity remains at socialsecurityradio.com. The website again is socialsecurityradio.com. Talk to you again next week. Bye.